Morning, Your Honor. Grover Brown, Gordon Pinares and Don Morello. With me is Mr. Peter Gordon and Mr. O'Keller.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. Jason Powell from the law firm of Ferry, Joseph, and Pierce. With me today is Thomas Riggs.
Welcome. Good morning. Ready to proceed? Please.
May it please the court, since our time is short, I'll assume no recitation of the facts is necessary and confine my remarks to the two essential points in the brief. First, that the court below committed reversible error when it found the May Pokebury Trust to be revocable. And second, that the court below committed reversible error when it failed to recognize the adult adoptee as a member of the class of beneficiaries under the October instrument. With respect to the May instrument, the court below concluded that the Gores intended to create a valid and enforceable trust when they executed the May Pokebury Trust. It was signed, witnessed, notarized, and funded with 1,000 shares of Pokebury Hills security stock, the same shares that were later used to fund the October instrument. The trust explicitly stated that the trust hereby created shall be irrevocable. However, despite the clear text of the May instrument, the court below found that the Gores intended to retain a right to modify the terms or revoke the May instrument. The court further concluded that the Gores intended for the May instrument to serve as a placeholder that would provide their estate some protection from taxes until a subsequent trust could be prepared. The court below thus granted revocability to the May instrument, despite finding no such revocability in the text prepared by the Gores' experienced tax attorney.
Mr. Sparks, I'm curious as to what rule of law underlies your argument. Is it that where the trust instrument states that it is irrevocable and the instrument is executed, duly executed, that there can be no further inquiry? That is a matter of law, that trust is irrevocable?
Yes, Your Honor, that's essentially correct. We're relying on the language in the restatement, the authorities cited in Scott on trusts, and prior decisions of this court, such as Equitable Trust Company versus Gallagher, for the proposition that if the settlor, has by its express terms failed to reserve a power of revocation, then the settlor cannot revoke the trust. In this case, the Gores were intelligent, highly motivated people. They certainly understood the meaning of the word irrevocable, and the Gores' primary purpose in creating the May Trust was to get the stock out of their estates for estate tax purposes, thereby avoiding a forced sale of the company stock to pay the tax.
But that shouldn't matter under your argument. I mean, under your argument, the only thing that matters is that the trust instrument states that it's irrevocable, period, end of case. Isn't that it? And when there's no right to revoke reserved.
I agree with that, Your Honor. I think once the court below concluded that the settlor was a valid and enforceable trust, that really was the end of it, and the court should not have looked to anything other than the Gore's purpose in creating that trust, particularly should not have looked to events that occurred after the execution of the trust.
Well, there's somewhat of an irony there, isn't there, that the trust is created for tax purposes, and because it says it's irrevocable with no reservation of any kind, then even if the tax law changes to obviate the original purpose of the trust, the knowledgeable settlors who are still extant at the time can't change the trust. They're trapped by their own device.
Well, again, I would not characterize it as being trapped in this case. I think it was a deliberate recognition on the part of the settlors, and again, contrary to the court below's placeholder theory, that the trust had to be irrevocable in order to properly exclude the assets from estate tax purposes. And, of course, that was properly reflected in the letter that Bill Gore sent to his financial advisor that same day that he executed the May instrument, when he described his estate planning objectives as being pretty well accomplished.
Was that a tax law fact presented to the Court of Chancery?
That's a matter of law, Your Honor. That's a question of law.
And well, I mean, the fact that was the law, that it had to be irrevocable in order to have the ultimate consequence, should they expire between the time of the May Trust and the eventual October Trust. It had to be irrevocable for that period of time, as I understand what you just said, in order for the corpus to escape inclusion in the estate.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that was a factual matter at the time of the execution of the instrument.
And
that was the law.
The Chancery was aware of that.
And the settlor was aware of that?
No, I'm not concerned about the settlor. I'm concerned about that particular point being made to the Court of Chancery.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
The argument that the actions taken by the settlor after the execution of the irrevocable May trust instrument to support the conclusion somehow that they reserved the power of revocation is contrary to established Delaware law, and it would create Delaware harmful Delaware precedent.
If the court were permitted to consider all this extrinsic evidence, and I understand your position is that it wasn't, then would it be the case that there was sufficient evidence to support the conclusion that the court drew?
I believe the answer to that is no, Your Honor, and that's for the reason stated earlier with respect to the fact that irrevocability was an absolute precondition to the exclusion of the assets for estate tax purposes. So whatever they did or didn't do afterward had to be consistent with that primary purpose of the settlor in excluding the assets from the estate and maintaining control of the company.
So your irrevocability argument really stands on two separate legs. One is it's as a matter of law rule, and the other is that you're using it as a fact that you contend is entitled to great, if not determinative, weight. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. I'd like to turn very briefly to the second question, which is the failure of the court below to recognize the adult adoptee as a member of the class of beneficiaries. And what I really want to say there is that the court below really did not follow the precedents of this court, particularly the Swanson case and the Chichester case, and most significantly the Chichester case, because in that case the court made it clear that where there was no evidence to the contrary in the instrument, the adult adoptee should not be presumed to be excluded. In fact, the presumption in the Chichester case, following the Haskell rule, was that the presumed intent of the Gores in this case was to rely on the law of adult adoption in Delaware and in effect at the time of the death of the survivor in applying the determination of the share allocation under the secondary term formula.
Did the Chancellor find language to the contrary in the document itself that would suggest that he did not.
He did not, Your Honor.
There's no reference.
He was relying on circumstantial evidence alone.
No reference to grandkids.
There is no reference to grandkids. The document itself merely refers to the definition of child, children, or issue of any person is child, children, or issue of that person by adoption as well as by blood. I see that I'm in my rebuttal time, so perhaps I might stop there.
Just one last question. What extrinsic evidence on this issue was the court permitted to consider in your side's view?
Well, again, in my view of this is that the Barker case in the Court of Chancery that was decided some time ago on this exact issue is quite correct. In the Barker case, the Court of Chancery
tell me the answer to my question.
The answer is there should be no circumstantial evidence to override the express language in the instrument permitting adoptees to be treated as members of the class for purposes of the secondary term distribution.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm here on behalf of the respondents, Jan P., Joel, and Nathan Otto. They are the ones that have come up under the court's ruling below 325 shares each short in the secondary term share trust that are to be set up as compared to the shares that will go into the share trust for their other 16 grandchildren. This appeal essentially is about three things as I see it, Your Honor. First would be the intent of Mr. and Mrs. Gore when they were establishing these trusts, or this trust. Second, whether the Delaware adoption law requires a different result than reached by the court below. And third is the May trust. Under Delaware law, can a person execute an irrevocable declaration of trust intending at the time that it not be irrevocable and revoke it later with another irrevocable trust? As to the intent of Mr. and Mrs. Gore, obviously, the dominant purpose was to get the Gore stock out of their estates to avoid the estate taxes that they saw coming. They saw with the advent of the new Gore-Tex product, the stock was going to go up in value. If it went up in value and one of them was unfortunately killed, They didn't have enough money to pay the taxes. They had to get stock out of their names. They set up the trust for the benefit of their grandchildren through the holding company. The thing I think is significant is that there are at least seven indications in the record and the exhibits where Mr. Gore referred to in some fashion equally as nearly as possible among grandchildren, equalize as nearly as possible among grandchildren. That was the overriding intent of everything they did. How it ended up, they wanted it to be equal among all their grandchildren as nearly as possible in the W.L. Gore stock derived from them. They treated their grandchildren.
Mr. Brown.
Yes.
Are you arguing that the overriding intent was that there be an equality of result or distribution as among all the grandchildren?
That's what I'd be. Equal as nearly as possible among grandchildren.
Of course, the court found to the contrary.
It found
that the equalization principle was one of expectation as distinguished from actual result. Do I correctly conclude that you're challenging the factual finding that was made?
No, I'm not. I'm not sure that I'm challenging the factual finding, Your Honor. It just seems to me that what was meant by expectations. I think any grandchild could expect to be treated equally from their grandparents. I don't know what Mr. and Mrs. Gore had in mind. And the thing is, prior to the time the May Trust was executed, nobody had passed on to Mr. Murdoch, their attorney, anything indicating what was later into the Pokeberry formula. There are insinuations in the opinion and the arguments against us that both before and after it was made clear that there was something intended by way of expectations.
So,
but the first time it appeared was the day after the May Trust was executed.
So the Vice Chancellor got the fact right but misunderstood the import of that fact?
We're talking about
expectations, but the expectation was that all of the grandchildren would end up with the same number of shares.
I don't know how you can look at the repeated reference to equal as nearly as possible over and over and over again and come to any other conclusion. It came out differently in the Pokeberry formula solely for the reason that Mrs. Susan Gore only had three children, while her siblings each had four. And that's what's perverted the whole thing. Can anybody really think that Mr. and Mrs. Gore, with all that back then, intended this result where 16 of their grandchildren got 419 shares and the other three got 94? I don't think so. But let me pass on from that, looking at the wrong clock, excuse me. They treated the grandchildren equally. They'd set up trust for them before, for the 11 that were alive at the time the Pokeberry Trust came into being. They treated them equally there. They treated them equally in the May Trust. And I don't know, as I said, Ward, the way they did doesn't come out treating them equally as nearly as possible. Turning to the adoption does accomplish that purpose. For the reason we set forth in our brief, is the adoption of J&C Auto. Was valid in compliance and permitted by both Delaware and Wyoming law. It was permitted and not prohibited by the language of the trust. October trust, it was in keeping with the decision of this court in both the Chichester case and the Swanson case, as Mr. Sparks pointed out. It was not done for any legal, fraudulent, or frivolous purpose. That's the test that's set forth in the Swanson case. And it carried out the equalization intended by Mr. and Mrs. Gore.
I thought the record reflected that between May and October there were discussions about doing the October trust per capita, and Mr. Gore decided against that.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, before, what was the time frame?
Before the October trust, we have the formula that we see now, but before there was a suggestion for the formula or decision to stay with the formula, and doesn't the record reflect that Mr. Gore specifically considered putting in something per capita and decided to stay with his formula?
I guess you could say that. I don't recall whether he specifically addressed that, but he certainly wanted to stick with his formula and not do it any other way. So I guess that
you end up the same. There's nothing in the record that there was a per capita discussion.
Not that I'm aware of. I could be wrong.
I might have read the record wrong.
Well, anyway, I think the significant thing there is that what really caused this controversy is not that there was an equalizing adoption, but who was adopted. I think that's what skewed the whole thing. If Susan Gore, for instance, had gone through international means and adopted a four-year-old orphan Vietnamese waif, we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be here now. It's because of who was adopted. If she had done that, there wouldn't be any problem about an emotional tie or whatever is bothering the court below. You certainly wouldn't have an argument that it was thwarting the intentions of the Gores, because even my opponents argued that the real meaning of the adoption provision was only minors could be adopted, not adults. Well, only a minor can be adopted, and the minor can change the plan, just as was done here. And if you can adopt a minor and end up with the same result, how can it be wrong if you adopt an adult, if the result's the same? In any event, to hold otherwise, it seems to me, is letting the court just kind of pick and choose on who's the proper adoptee and who's not. I think that's what was bothering the court below. It's how the adoption came about and who was adopted. And he just couldn't quite buy that. Finally, since I'm in my sum-up time, I'll go along with Mr. Sparks on the May Trust argument. There was any number of factual findings in the court below that are not supported by the evidentiary record. In page 3, for instance, it starts off by saying, large percentage of the May Trust corpus would have to be sold to pay estate taxes. That's not so. Even their own expert witnesses indicated that there was no estate taxes due under the May Trust. There's another reference that in the second quarter, the Gores were waiting on...
When you say that's not so, do you mean there's no evidence to support that, or that the evidence from supporting your side is more weighty?
Well, I'm saying that the experts for the other side agreed on cross-examination there was no estate tax due under on the Gores estate under the May Trust.
I'm not sure what that means in the context of this case. Does it mean that no matter which trust is the valid, irrevocable trust, there won't be an extraordinary amount of money owed to the federal government? There's no tax consequence of the result of
this case? I think not, Your Honor. They're both irrevocable trusts. If it's a revocable trust, like the court below found, then it's in their estates. It would have been in their estates. That's been the Internal Revenue Law since 1936. If you're set up a revocable trust, you can take it away. It's yours. And yet, that's the ruling of the court below, that it's all right because what they intended was a revocable trust because that provided them some measure of protection. I don't think it does. I see my time's up, so
unless
there's any further questions, I'll withdraw. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Jason Powell from the law firm of Ferry, Joseph and Pierce, on behalf of appellant Jan C. Otto. The court below, the Court of Chancery, held a one-day trial in March of 2010 and rendered an opinion later that year on September 1st. In that opinion, the Vice Chancellor Noble found that the equitable defense of unclean hands barred my client, Jan C., from claiming any benefit in the Pokeberry Trust. It is respectfully submitted that this decision is an error for several reasons. First, the Court of Chancery erred by addressing a cause of action not in the pretrial stipulation, i.e. not before the court. This court found in its opinion that my client owed his ex-wife and his children a fiduciary duty and by virtue of a confidential relationship. He breached that duty, and such breach implicated the equitable defense of unclean hands. This is an argument that the appellees first set forth for their first time in their post-trial brief. There was a petition for construction filed in this case. The appellees both filed their separate respective answers. For example, the co-trustees in their answer set forth their affirmative defenses, unclean hands, waiver, etc. The objecting grandchildren also filed a separate pleading as their answer and set forth their affirmative defenses, breach of fiduciary duty, waiver, and unclean hands. Separate and distinct affirmative defenses were set forth. They combined forces and filed a summary judgment motion based on waiver and unclean hands. The Court of Chancery denied that motion but directed an expedited trial on waiver and unclean hands. Accordingly, the parties entered into a pretrial stipulation agreeing that the issues were narrowly framed. Waiver and unclean hands were the only issues to be addressed at the March 2010 trial. There was no mention of breach of fiduciary duty. It was not mentioned in discovery. It was not mentioned in the pretrial briefing, the pretrial stipulation, or even at trial.
You seem to be drawing a distinction between breach of fiduciary duty as a claim for relief and breach of fiduciary duty as an element of unclean hands. It may well be the case that there was no claim for relief, but why was it impermissible to rely on breach of fiduciary duty as an element of unclean hands? And if it was procedurally not in the case, to what extent or how precisely was your side prejudiced by that?
Well, our side would be prejudiced because we weren't aware of what the case. We were prepared for waiver and unclean hands, and it is an issue of fundamental fairness. The parties are bound by what they stipulate to, and in this case, it was waiver and unclean hands.
Yeah, but I'm asking you to get beyond the level of theory. Was there some different fact or evidence that would have been introduced into the record had this surfaced at the beginning?
If we were aware of unclean hands, we certainly would have addressed, excuse me, if we were aware of breach of fiduciary duty, we certainly would have focused on the confidential relationship that the court eventually found. In this case, the court
addressed... What I'm asking is, why is this not just a matter of argument, another argument based on the same facts?
My response would be, Your Honor, that unclean hands and breach of fiduciary duty are two separate and distinct legal theories. They both have their separate substantive standards of evidence. They have their different burdens of proof. They have their different analysis that is necessary. And it is...
What's the difference in the burden of proof?
Well, I submit that in connection with breach of fiduciary duties, in finding a confidential relationship, it must be clear and convincing evidence. And the court found they didn't really address the burden of proof issue in the decision below. They simply found a confidential relationship. And in finding that confidential relationship, Your Honor, they focused on two separate relationships, Jan C. and his ex-wife, and Jan C. and his sons.
Well, let me ask Justice Jacobs' question a little bit differently. On what basis were you on notice that the other parties asserted that your client was operating with unclean hands in this case?
My client was on notice of unclean hands, as that was the basis for the case. The pretrial stipulations that we agreed upon indicated that unclean hands was the basis, but that was because of the representations, the alleged representations that were made prior to the adoption. And can these casual email exchange give rise to unclean hands? It was not an issue of was there a confidential relationship whereby trust was reposed in my client. That was not on notice to my client prior to the trial.
So your notice, as you recall it, was that the basis for an assertion of unclean hands as a bar to your relief would be that your client made factual material misrepresentations to the other side?
Essentially, Your Honor, there were dozens of memorandums, emails back and forth among these parties.
Is that the basis that you were on notice that the other side would use to support their claim of unclean hands as a bar to your relief?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. They picked a few representations out of the many and attempted to define an enforceable agreement to show a misrepresentation. Now, that is not exactly what the court found. The court found a confidential relationship existed between my client and his ex-spouse and the children, and therefore then came to the conclusion.
Right, and that surprised you in some material way that made it impossible or at least extraordinarily difficult
to deal with
the unclean hands?
Yes, in post-trial briefing. Because at that point, they both were represented by counsel. That would have been a particular point that would have been, I think, of interest to the court in finding a confidential relationship. In addition, there was no detriment to Susan Gore or her children. The court found, relied on two considerations that found that there was a confidential relationship. Number one, his familial relationship, i.e. ex-spouse being their father. And then number two, that he exerted some sort of control to their detriment. There was no detriment to Susan or the Otto grandchildren here. And I can illustrate that by talking about the three cases that are cited by the appellees and adopted by the court. Those are the Wagner and the Elliott and the other case whereby these were constructive trust cases whereby the defendant owned property of record, usually real property, but the plaintiff had provided funds to buy that or had paid expenses. The relationship went sour, and then the plaintiff sought equitable relief by virtue of a constructive trust. In those cases, the courts found that the owner of record was in a place of domination, superiority, because they could sell, transfer, encumber the property. That was not the case here, and that is a major distinction that I wanted to address to the court. I'm available if you have questions. I'm in my rebuttal time. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, if acceptable to the court, I'll address the adoption issue, and my friend Mr. Ho will address the trust instrument issue. After a three-day trial, the Court of Chancery found that Susan Gore's adoption of her ex-husband to serve as a spacer adoptee, that is her word, a spacer, was pursued for the sole and improper purpose of thwarting the Gore's intentions regarding the Pokeberry Trust, and he therefore should be excluded as a trust beneficiary. The Court of Chancery's decision should be affirmed for three reasons. First, as the Court of Chancery found, Susan Gore's adoption of her ex-husband would nullify the Pokeberry formula and the carefully crafted expectation provisions of the trust instrument. Second, as the Court of Chancery found, the Gores did not intend to provide for adult adoptees with whom their children had no parent-child relationship and, unique to this case, the potential adoptee had been stripped of all rights that an adopted child would have before that adult was adopted. And third, the Court of Chancery's decision and findings fit comfortably within Delaware precedent construing trust instruments as a whole and finding dispositive the settlor's intent when determining the class of beneficiaries who take under a trust instrument. Both the trust instrument and the drafting history in the record show that Bill and Veve Gore intended a presumption that each grandchild would take the same amount from their parents that the parents received from Mr. and Mrs. Gore. This expectation, as Justice Jacobs had pointed out earlier, this expectation would apply even where family lines were uneven, meaning a family line with fewer grandchildren was presumed to receive more from their parents and therefore would receive less from the Pokeberry Trust. And this presumption expectation would be applied, quote, even though in fact this is not so, close quote, from the Gores, Mr. and Mrs. Gore's mouth and in the instrument, meaning that the Gores recognized in the instrument that not all grandchildren actually receive the same expectation amount from their parents. Now, there was some question about whether there was anything in the drafting history, I believe from Justice Holland, about this expectation provision. And there is a rich drafting history that is part of this record, showing that this expectation provision was central to the Gore's thinking in setting up the Pokeberry Trust, and that the Gore's insistence on keeping this provision was paramount to them over the contrary recommendation of their attorney, Mr. Murdoch.
And does the record include an exchange about doing it per capita in lieu of the formula?
It does, Your Honor. If you look at the R appendix at B626, Exhibit J86, you'll find that exchange on how the Gores explicitly rejected a per capita distribution in favor of the expectation provisions that were actually adopted as part of the October instrument. Now, the lower court found, based on a mountain of evidence, that by adopting her ex-husband, Susan Gore, and her children, because her children really put her up to it, sought to nullify the expectation provisions of the Pokeberry formula. The spacer adoption that was pursued by Susan Gore and her children, by adopting her ex-husband, who was stripped of all rights that an adopted child might have, might benefit from, was something that the Gores would have specifically rejected.
Do you agree with Mr. Brown that if it had been a different person adopted, everyone wouldn't be here today?
I agree that if a different person who had a parent-child relationship was adopted, for instance, a minor, the example that Mr. Brown gave, we would not be here today. And knowing what I know of the Gore family, there would not even be an issue about a true adopted minor child like that. But we're here today because there was a conscious intent to manipulate the Pokeberry formula by the adoption of her ex-husband.
Mr. Seitz, I want to go back to your second argument, which, as I understand it, is that although the trust instrument did provide that an adopted grandchild would be treated like any other grandchild, the Gore's settlers did not have in mind this kind of adoption.
That's right, Your Honor.
What is the evidence supporting that?
Well, first, let me make a slight modification. The trust has been provided for the adoption of children. The issue of grandchildren were not defined in the instrument, and the reason the petition for construction was filed in this case is because the petitioner, Susan Gore, declared that the issue of who were grandchildren under the Pokeberry Trust was ambiguous. You will find that ambiguity statement in their petition. So what is the evidence there for that?
Okay, so the ambiguity, at least at the grandchild level, is what opens the door for consideration of extrinsic evidence.
That's right, Your Honor, although I would argue that under this court's decision in Anand versus Wilmington Trust Company, that those rules of construction and even preclusion of considering parole evidence take a back seat, as this court essentially said, to efforts to determine what exactly were the intent of the grantors when they set up this trust, which include taking into account the circumstances of its formation, which in this case takes into account the evidence in the record of why it is they thought that only children would qualify as grandchildren under this trust. If you look at the, there's an April 1972 memo.
You're saying if Susan had not conceded ambiguity, the result would be no different.
I believe that's correct under this court's decision in Anand versus Bloomington Trust Company, because I think if the intention of the court or the precedent of this court has always been to what is the intent of the settlors, and that basically almost any evidence can be considered to determine what the intent of a settlor is, to divine that intent from the instrument as a whole, from extrinsic evidence, from the circumstances surrounding this creation. Back to your factual question, which is what is in the record to show that the Gores intended only to benefit children, meaning minor children, there is an April 1972 memo at B581 in the record where the Gores contemplated that the class of beneficiaries, well, they initially contemplated that the class would close when Betty Gore, who was the youngest daughter, reaches 45 years of age, or, quote, all of our grandkids are born. They use the term grandkids. Certainly contemplate evidence of contemplating that a minor child was contemplated by the Gores in the Pokeberry Trust Instrument, and that factual determination by the court below, the trial court below, should be entitled to deference. There are also earlier drafts of the Pokeberry Instrument where the Gores were going to exclude certain adopted grandchildren. They would be grandchildren who were not adopted by one of their children. They decided to change that, and again, quoting, they changed our mind about adopted grandkids and have therefore deleted that paragraph. That's at Exhibit J86 in the record B626. The Court of Chancery relied upon those two documents to support its conclusion that the Gore's intentions were to benefit minor children who had a parent-child relationship with their children instead of a spacer adoptee who was adopted solely for the purpose of nullifying the Pokeberry formula.
And the way I read that exchange in the record, at one time it would have excluded the adoption of stepchildren, but now that's what they changed their mind about. But it's consistent with your argument that they were still focusing on children and a parent-child relationship.
That's exactly right. There is nothing in the record other than those two documents which the fair import of those documents is that minor children in a parent-child relationship were what were contemplated by adopted children and grandchildren in the Pokeberry Trust Instrument. And let me turn finally to why this fits comfortably within the court's existing case law. I think we heard argument that somehow this decision was contrary to the Swanson case. The Swanson case only addressed the validity of an adoption per se for economic reasons. And what the petitioners here have failed to distinguish is the court's case law when an adoptee is taking from an adopted parent versus when an adoptee is taking through an adopted parent. And that is the distinction between Swanson and the Chichester case, because in the Chichester case, when you adopt through, then there is a more searching inquiry when a stranger to the adoption creates an instrument. The question then becomes, is that person within the intended class of beneficiaries as the settlors intended? And it's a different issue than was presented in Swanson. And here, we have clear evidence that it would be just incredible to believe, if you ask the Gores, whether a spacer adoptee stripped of all rights that an adopted child might have was contemplated to be a grandchild who would take under this trust. But we don't have to guess in this case about whether they really intended it. We have evidence in the record where Mrs. Gore, at her 90th birthday, was asked by the Ottos whether she would consent to change the formula because they thought it was unfair. And as the record shows, Mrs. Gore, at her 90th birthday, said a firm no. She refused to change the formula, even though, as was testified, it almost killed her, the whole discussion about changing the Pokeberry formula. In conclusion, the Court of Chancery found that the adult adoption of Susan's ex-husband as her child to serve as a spacer adoptee was contrary to and nullified the Pokeberry formula, and also was not consistent with the intent of the Gores to benefit only minor adopted children and those that had a parent-child relationship. The Court of Chancery's ruling should be affirmed. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Derek Ho on behalf of the co-trustees of the Pokeberry Trust. The court below found that the Gores did not intend to create an irrevocable trust under the May instrument. And legally, there is no dispute that that factual finding means that the October instrument governs the Pokeberry Trust. That factual finding was not clearly erroneous because it was supported by a mountain of evidence. I'd like to highlight just a few pieces of that evidence.
Before you do that.
Yes, Your Honor.
It's undisputed that the Gores did execute the May Trust.
It's undisputed that the Gores signed the May Trust.
It's undisputed that the May Trust self-declares as irrevocable. If, despite that, their intention was not to for that trust to be irrevocable, then what purpose did the? Why did they sign it? What is the coherent story that makes sense out of what actually happened here?
We think that the coherent story is what the court below found, which is that the Gores signed the May instrument because they thought signing a document, even though it wasn't complete, even though it wasn't their final Pokeberry Trust instrument, would provide some advantage with respect to the IRS and provide some protection against estate taxes. What's, I think, more important, though, is why they didn't sign the...
Well, in other words, if they were both die in a common disaster before the October Trust was completed and executed, then the intent was that the May Trust would be there as the final disposition?
No, Your Honor, I don't think that that's what the court below was suggesting. I think what the court below was suggesting was that they were in the process of reducing to writing the terms of a trust that they had already in substance decided on. It's important to recall that by May 8th, the Gores had already instructed their lawyer, Mr. Murdoch, to include in substance equality of expectations as opposed to equality of result, and to include a provision in the trust that would provide that the assets would remain in trust during the lifetimes of the grandchildren. In concept, the terms of the trust were set. What remained to be done was to reduce the terms of the trust to a writing, and as the evidence shows, it took quite a while for Mr. Gore and Mr. Murdoch to come up with a language embodying the concept of equality
right.
of expectations.
And what they could have done was to leave the May Trust in unsigned form and let it sit there. If it's meant just as a monument to or as a record of where they had progressed to, although it wasn't the finish line, yet they signed it.
I think that it's quite possible that, you know, another person might have just done as you suggested. The Gores obviously signed it because they thought that it might be helpful to have some evidence that there were that there was a trust or that they were working on a trust at that time. But the critical thing is that the Gores did not sign that document with the intention that it be the final, irrevocable Pokeberry trust instrument. And the evidence to support that is enormous. The Gores never revealed the existence of the Pokeberry of the May Pokeberry trust instrument to a single person. By contrast, for more than 35 years, they held out the October instrument as their final Pokeberry trust instrument to their family, who relied upon it for their own estate planning. There was evidence at trial to that effect. To their advisors, who relied on it in helping them administer the trust for 35 years, and under penalties of perjury to the IRS. Moreover, the May instrument on its face does not look like any of their other final irrevocable trust instruments. And if I could just take a moment to show visually why that's the case, both to illustrate the power of the evidence as well as to explain that this is the kind of factual finding that is uniquely the province of the trial court. This is what the Gore's final trust documents look like. They all have colored backers and they all bear their initials on the schedule containing the trust corpus. This is the May instrument. And this is the October instrument. What the May instrument on its face, the May instrument looks completely different from all of the other final trust instruments that the Gores created. It doesn't contain their initials on the document, and it doesn't contain this color backer. With respect to the color backer, there was evidence at trial that the Gores, for some of their other trusts, were provided with form trust agreements by their lawyer to fill in as each grandchild was born so that they didn't have to go back to Mr. Murdoch for another completed instrument. Even with respect to those instruments, the Gores put their initials on the schedule and they found a piece of colored paper to attach to the back of the instrument. In some cases, because they didn't have the official blue ones, they were pink. And in other instances, because they had other blue sheets of paper lying around that have order forms for wire strippers and cutters on them. That was the Gore business, obviously. That's what they put on the document. That was the way in which they expressed their final intention to create a trust. And the May document lacks any of the objective indicia of a final instrument according to the formal procedures that the Gores uniformly used for over 11 years and 27 irrevocable trusts. The May instrument also, the very next day, the Gores wrote to Mr. Murdoch and said, please change the language of the trust to implement the terms that we had explained to you earlier. And Mr. Gore referred to the trust as drafted. Further evidence that the May instrument was not the final version of the trust. There's yet a third piece of very important evidence, which is that the May instrument wholly defeats the core estate planning objectives of the Gores. First, it defeats their deeply held conception of equality of expectations as opposed to equality of result, which Mr. Gore had developed as of November of 1971, again, months before the May document, and which, as Mr. Seitz pointed out, Vive Gore reaffirmed in 2003 when she rejected Nathan Otto's desperate plea to change the trust. Moreover, the May instrument inflicts gross, grievous estate tax consequences on the Gore family, so much so that on the last page of the Otto appellant's brief, they make clear that if they can have any other form of relief that they sought below and that they seek in this court, they would prefer those forms of relief to recognition of the May document. Because although the May document doesn't contain the Pokeberry formula, and they are thus advantaged by the elimination of the equality of expectations that the Gores intended, the tax consequences of the May document are so bad that they would prefer to have the adoption recognized. They would prefer to just invalidate the Pokeberry formula within the October instrument, and if only
let,
if...
Let me interrupt on that.
Yes,
point.
Justice Berger.
I understand that there was a mediation that took place and that, at least by some people's view, an agreement reached that would have resolved this matter that was signed off on by the chancellor, who was the mediator, but that the trial court decided that it was unenforceable. What is your view with respect to that mediation agreement?
Our view with respect to that mediation agreement is that it is unenforceable for the straightforward reason under Rule 174 of the Court of Chancery's rules that not all parties agreed to the allocation that was reached by some of the parties at the mediation formula, at the mediation rather. In particular, the co-trustees never agreed to that allocation, and it was signed by only some of the grandchildren. It was also missing from the mediation were the adult great-grandchildren of the Gores, who have a vested interest in the allocation of the Gore of the assets of the trust. So in short, our position is that it was an agreement reached by some but not all of the parties, and that under Rule 74, a partial agreement is not enforceable.
Well, just help me with this, because apparently a large group of people, including attorneys and including the chancellor, showed up and went through a process designed to resolve this matter. And at the end of one day, 2 days, whatever it was, had reached an agreement that included those people who were there being representatives of various people who were not there, and that was understood throughout the mediation, and the chancellor signs off on it. All of those things suggest that there was actually an agreement and that the parties were all represented, if not there. I also saw something in the record about how the co-trustees submitted letters indicating that they agreed with the mediation results. So how does that square with what you're saying?
I think our position is that the mediation agreement was viewed at the time as an important first step toward an actual mediated resolution of the case. There was agreement by some but not all of the parties to that mediation agreement, but that the co-trustees had not signed off on it. Susan Gore had not signed off it. Other parties who would have had to be at the table, namely the adult great-grandchildren, had not signed off on it. And so although I think the chancellor believed that a lot of progress had been made on that date, that progress never came to fruition in the form of a complete mediation agreement that would be enforceable under Rule 74.
Mr. Ho, excuse me. Suppose, hypothetically, that the vice chancellor had held, this is counterfactually, that I will enforce the mediation with respect to the parties who signed off on it, but not as to any parties who did not. Would that have been practicable?
No, Your Honor, because there were adult great-grandchildren who are the descendants of the grandchildren and who are the remaindermen of each of the Pokeberry Trust. In other words, the grandchildren are merely the income beneficiaries of the Pokeberry Trust. The principal of the trust will go to the great-grandchildren of the Gores and the adult great-grandchildren of the Gores, who would have had to participate in any resolution in order for it to be binding, were not even present at the mediation. So I think the mediation was, again, an viewed at the time as an important first step.
Why could not the court have held that as to the great-grandchildren that were not represented, that the mediation wouldn't be binding?
Your Honor, it's not clear to me how it would be practical to bind some parties but not others to an allocation of a trust when that allocation of the trust will affect not only the people who were present at the mediation but the remaindermen of the trust who are not present. If it's not binding on them, then it really isn't a binding agreement for anybody, because it can't, the mediation can't practicably be enforced against some but not all of the parties. the allocation either affects everybody or it affects nobody. I'd like to...
I have one question that continues to trouble me. After reading the papers, I was left with the impression there was a significant difference in terms of tax consequences of which of the May or the November trust were the operable trust here. I heard in the initial argument that it made no difference. Now you're telling me again it does make a difference. Is there a significant difference between the tax consequences of any ruling from this court?
Your Honor, I see that my time has expired.
You can answer my question. I control the clock.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, there is a huge difference. The difference is that the May instrument distributes the assets of the trust out of trust at the death of Bill and Veeve Gore. In other words, they wind up in the estates of the grandchildren of the Gores, whereas under the October instrument, the assets are distributed out of trust at the earliest after the deaths of the grandchildren of the Gores. In other words, they wind up in the estates of the great-grandchildren of the Gores. That is to say that estate taxes will have to be paid one generation earlier under the May instrument than under the October instrument, thus accelerating the payment of the need to pay the estate taxes and critically jeopardizing or complicating family control of W.L. Gore and Associates one generation earlier than the Gores had wanted. And because that is clearly contrary to what the Gores' ultimate intent was, we believe that the court, the decision below should be affirmed.
Thank you.
I know that my rebuttal time is short, and Mr. Powell has graciously offered to allow me to take some of his as well. I want to focus on the essential point that while my opponents continue to argue about factual findings, both questions that I addressed are matters of law to be determined by this court de novo. The question of whether the adult adoptee should be recognized as a member of the class for purposes of the secondary term distribution is a question that should be decided as a matter of law and consistently with the Swanson holding and, more importantly, the Chichester holding, which requires that there be a presumed intent on the part of the Gores that the adult adoptee is to be treated as a member of the class absent express and unambiguous language in the instrument to the contrary. And again, the only language we have in the instrument here is the language that treats adopted issue in the same manner as biological issue. Similarly, with respect to the question of the revocability of the May Trust, I have the same position. As a matter of law, a signed and funded trust expressly stated to be irrevocable can't be revoked or altered by the settlor's later execution of an instrument purporting to dispose of the same assets. It's a matter of law. Again, decided under...
Before you leave that point, you said signed and funded. Where does the record reflect that the May Trust was funded?
The schedule itself, Your Honor, Schedule A to the May Trust, indicates 1,000 shares of Pokebury Hill Security stock.
I know it says that on the schedule, but at some point in time, don't you really have to do something to put those shares in the name of the May Trust?
There is a transfer of the stock that's there, but again, the completion of the gift occurs at the time of the funding of the trust, as evidenced in the schedule.
Well, wasn't there a stock power signed transferring those 1,000 shares in connection with the October instrument, but not the May instrument?
I don't believe that's the case, Your Honor. The other point that I wanted to make is on the estate tax consequence, because it was his primary purpose to exclude the assets from the estate. And very briefly there is no distinction between the May Trust and the October Trust that relates to the estate tax consequences arising as a result of the death of the settlors. The only estate tax consequence that's different between the May and the October Trust is the far-reaching, far-out-into-the-future estate tax difference that would arise upon the deaths of the grandchildren of the settlors. So when Mr. Gore wrote to his financial advisor on May the 8th and said his estate planning objectives were pretty well accomplished, that was in fact the truth with respect to the absence of any inclusion of those assets in his estate for estate tax purposes. Thank you.
I think everyone's out of time unless I've misread the clock, Mr. Brown. I'll Well, counsel, thank you. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Aye.